And that, of course, was Mark Levy from his album Shiro's Heroes. An old one, but one of my favorites. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. You're listening to Robert Norse. That's me. Also in the studio with me, backing me up, is Barbara Tiger of Clearview Court. In case you've got some questions for her, comments, she may make some commentary on some of the other stuff that's happening, because I'm going to be covering other things than the City Council's sellout of the rent control ordinance, which affects, of course, both De Anza and Clearview Court, as well as the rest of us. Phone number here is 427-3772, area code 831 if you're outside, 427-3772 if you're outside the county. If you want to catch Free Radio Santa Cruz voicemail, leave a message for us, public service announcement. It's easy to do, 427-4523, 427-4523. You want to leave us some money, donate some equipment, maybe you want something announced, you want to join the collective. 427-4523. You can also write us at P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And in case you're listening on the internet, we do stream at www.freakradio.org, www.freakradio, one word, small letters, freakradio.org. Email us at frsc at freakradio.org. And you can email the show at rnorse2, rnorse, R-N-O-R-S-E 2, at hotmail.com, or you can call in at 427-3772. Now on Sunday, when I do another show, and a longer one, we're going to be having a very special interview with an author who I was very impressed by, and hence set up the interview with. The man's name is Robert Whitaker. Name of the book he wrote is called Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. Whitaker was interviewed for Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper, back in June. You can still get copies of that if you're interested by contacting Becky Johnson at 429-8529 or checking with the Homeless Service Center. They may still have some copies there, or the Page Smith Community House. Or looking for the car with all the bumper stickers on it. That's my car usually. There are other cars joining my car in bumper sticker land, but I'm the one with probably the most bumper stickers most of the time. I often have street spirits with me. Be happy to pass one on to you. If you're homeless, it's free. In fact, you can sell them if you're homeless for a dollar a piece. If you're not homeless, you got to give away a dollar, not to me, but to a homeless person. Yes, I know they might use it for tobacco. Yeah, they might go out and buy a beer, but that's the breaks. That's what the cost of getting street spirit is. The need for money so people can actually get out of the rain occasionally, have a cup of coffee, buy some tampons if they need to, you know, the usual needs that most of us take for granted, or somewhat, anyway. It's easier for us when we are, of course, have homes, which is another, of course, link up on the issue of folks in mobile homes and what they're faced with. They are going to have their homes, I guess, for a while under this rent control ordinance, but it becomes much more uncertain for them, and it's a move toward homelessness for a large number of people. But Mad in America, Robert Whitaker, he's written a great book. It's a book that talks about, it was generated by a study that he ran across as a Boston Globe writer. He wasn't particularly interested in psychiatry or fighting for the rights of those incarcerated in mental hospitals or anything of that sort, apparently. But he came across some disturbing results that the World Health Organization had found, namely that the treatment of schizophrenia in underdeveloped countries was twice as effective as the treatment in developed countries like the United States, Russia, Western Europe. That is to say, people diagnosed as schizophrenic and treated in Western countries recovered in half as many cases. It was an amazing statistic, and he thought, well, how can that be? Was there some magic bullet that these underdeveloped countries have? Well, maybe they all have some mysterious shaman. Is it, you know, cosmic rays? Is it something in the soil? What is it? And there were three different countries. There were Colombia, Nigeria, and India, very different countries. One of them is Islamic, one of them, you know, different languages, different climates. What was the common denominator? The common denominator was the Western countries all used massive amounts of drugs on the people. Psychotropic drugs. Thorazine, stelazine, and now more recently things like Zyprexa and other so-called improved drugs. And his conclusions, this particular discrepancy led him to a long investigation, and we're going to be talking about that. His book talks about it. I'm going to read you the epilogue to his book. It isn't very long, and he will be on the air, as I say, on Sunday, 10 o'clock on this station, 10 a.m. in the morning. And you can also get this book in the library, Robert Whitaker's Mad in America. And here's his epilogue. This book began with a straightforward goal, and that was to explore why schizophrenia outcomes are so poor in the United States today. It seemed like a simple question, and yet it quickly opened the door to a larger story, the story of how we as a society have historically treated those we call mad. It clearly is a troubled history, one that begs to be better known. There are perhaps many lessons that can be drawn from it, but one seems to stand out above all others. Any hope of reforming our care of those, quote, ill with schizophrenia will require us to rediscover in our science a capacity for humility and candor. There is one moment in the past where we can find such humility. It could be seen in moral therapy as practiced in its most ideal form by the Quakers in York, England, or by Thomas Kirkbride at the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane in the mid-19th century. In their writings, the York Quakers regularly confessed that they understood little about any possible causes, physical causes, of madness. But what they did see clearly was brethren who were suffering and needed comfort. That was the understanding that drove their care. And so they sought to run their asylum in a way that was best for their patients rather than in a way that was best for them as managers of the asylum. They put their patients' comforts and needs first. They also perceived of their patients as having a God-given capacity for recovery and thus simply tried to assist nature in helping them heal. It was care that was at once humanitarian and optimistic, and it did help many get well. But equally important, the York Quakers were quite willing to accept that many of their brethren would continue in their crazy ways. That was all right, too. They would provide a refuge for those who could not regain their mental health and at least make sure they had warm shelter and good food. In the 1960s, as the United States set out to reform its care, it did look back to moral treatment for inspiration. President John Kennedy and the Joint Commission on Mental Illness and Mental Health spoke of the need for American society to see those who were distraught in mind as part of the human family and deserving of empathy. Eugenics had stirred America to treat the severely mentally ill with scorn and neglect, and it was time to change our ways. We would welcome the mentally ill back into society. Asylums would be replaced with community care. But the design of that reform also rested on a medical notion of the most unusual sort, that neuroleptics might be described as moral treatment in pill form. The confusion in that perception was profound. Neuroleptics were a medical treatment with roots in frontal lobotomy and the brain-damaging therapeutics of the eugenics era. Our vision for reform and the medical treatment that would be the cornerstone of that reform were hopelessly at odds. Something had to give, and the moment of choice occurred very early on. The research study that launched the emptying of the state hospitals was the 6-week trial conducted by the National Institute of Mental Health in the early 1960s, which concluded that neuroleptics, by which they mean tranquilizers, Thorazine, Stelazine, Haldol, were safe and anti-schizophrenic. But then, a very short while later, the National Institute for Mental Health found in a follow-up study that the patients who had been treated with neuroleptics were more likely than the placebo patients to have been re-hospitalized. Something clearly was amiss. A choice, in essence, was presented to psychiatry. Would it hold to the original vision of reform, which called for the provision of care that would promote recovery? If so, it would clearly need to rethink the merits of neuroleptics. The drugs were apparently making people chronically ill, and that was quite apart from whatever other drawbacks they might have. Or would it cast aside questions of recovery and instead defend the drugs? There can be no doubt today about which choice American psychiatry made. Evidence of the harm caused by the drugs was simply allowed to pile up and up and then pushed away in the corner where it wouldn't be seen. There was Bakhtin's study that relapse rates were lower in the pre-neuroleptic era, Rappaport's study, Mosher's, reports of the neuroleptic malignant syndrome and tardive dyskinesia, Van Putten's report of medicated patients in boarding homes spending their days idly looking at television, too numbed in mind and spirit to even have a favorite program, studies detailing the high incidence of akathisia, Parkinson's, and a myriad of other types of motor dysfunction, case reports of akathisia driving patients so out of their minds it made them suicidal or even homicidal. Harding's study and then the World Health Organization studies, all of this research told of suffering and of loss. And where were the studies showing the drugs were leading people to recovery? Researchers studiously avoided this question. In 1998, British investigators reviewed the published results of 2,000 clinical trials of neuroleptics over the previous 50 years and found that only 1 in 25 studies even bothered to assess daily living activities or social functioning. The trials, again and again, simply looked at whether the drugs knocked down visible symptoms of psychosis and ignored what was really happening to people as to patients as people. It is not difficult today to put together a wish list for reform. An obvious place to start would be to revisit the work of Emile Krapelin. He was the fellow who initially set up the definitions of schizophrenia and madness in the 1800s. Were many of his psychotic patients actually suffering from encephalitis lethargica? And has that led to an overly pessimistic view of schizophrenia? Encephalitis lethargica was actually a physical ailment that was mistaken for a mental ailment. The next step would be to investigate what the poor countries were doing right. How are the mad treated in India and Nigeria? What are the secrets of care beyond not keeping patients regularly medicated that help so many people in those countries get well? Closer to home, any number of studies would be welcome. A study that compares neuroleptics to sedatives would be welcome. How would conventional treatments stack up against the care that provided delusional people with a safe place to live, food, and the use of sedatives to help restore their sleep-wake cycles? Or how about a National Institute for Mental Health-funded experiment modeled on the work of Finnish investigators? There, physicians led by Irjo Alman at the University of Turku have developed a treatment program that combines social support, family therapy, vocational therapy, and the selective use of antipsychotics. They're picking apart differences in patient types and have found that some patients do better with low doses of antipsychotics and others with no drugs at all. They're reporting great results, a majority of patients so treated are remaining well for years and holding jobs, so why not try it here? At the top of this list, wish list, though, would be a simple plea for honesty. Stop telling those diagnosed with schizophrenia that they suffer from too much dopamine or serotonin activity and that the drugs put these brain chemicals back into, quote, balance. That whole spiel is a form of medical fraud, and it is impossible to imagine any other group of patients ill, say, with cancer or cardiovascular disease being deceived in this way. In truth, the prevailing view in American psychiatry today is that there are any number of factors, biological and environmental, that can lead to schizophrenia. A person's genetic makeup obviously may play a role. Relatives of people with schizophrenia appear to be at increased risk of developing the disorder, and thus the thought is that they may inherit genes that make them less able to cope with environmental stress. The genetic factors are said to predispose people to schizophrenia rather than cause it. Another prominent theory is that complications during pregnancy or during delivery may affect the developing brain, and that this trauma leads to deficiencies in brain function once neuronal systems have matured. Yet another thought is that some people with schizophrenia have difficulty filtering incoming sensory data, and that this problem is due to abnormal function in brain cells known as interneurons. A number of investigators are still studying the role that different neurotransmitters may play in the disorder. The biological paths to schizophrenia may be many, but none is yet known for sure. It is also possible that the capacity to go mad, as it were, is in all of us. Extreme emotional trauma can clearly trigger psychosis, and some argue that psychosis is a mechanism for coping with that trauma. That view of the disorder is consistent with the fact that in the absence of neuroleptics, Thorazine, Haldol, many people who suffer a schizophrenic break recover from it and never relapse again. Thus, if we wanted to be candid today in our talk about schizophrenia, we would admit to this. Little is known about what causes schizophrenia. Antipsychotic drugs do not fix any known brain abnormality, nor do they put brain chemistry back into balance. What they do is alter brain function in a manner that diminishes certain characteristic symptoms, which is a change. We also know what they cause is an increase in dopamine receptors, which is a change associated both with tardive dyskinesia and increased biological vulnerability to psychosis, and that long-term outcomes are much better in countries where such medications are less frequently used. Although such candor might be humbling to our sense of medical prowess, it might also lead us to rethink that we as a society should do what we should do to help those who struggle with madness. But none of this, I'm afraid, is going to happen. Olanzapine is now Eli Lilly's top-selling drug, surpassing even Prozac. Olanzapine is the new mental health drug. I think it's dyspraxia. I've got to actually get the names of these drugs down, and I'm hoping that Whitaker will have all this. I'm sure he will. in detail when we come back on Sunday. There will be no rethinking of the merits of a form of care that is bringing profits to so many. Indeed, it is hard to be optimistic that the future will bring any break with the past. There is no evidence of any budding humility in American psychiatry that might stir the introspection that would be necessary first step toward reform. At least in the public arena, all we hear about are advancements in knowledge and treatment as if the march of progress is certain. Eli Lilly and Janssen, large drug companies, have even teamed up with leaders of U.S. mental health advocacy groups to mount educational missions to poor countries in East Asia so we can export our model of care to them. Hubris is everywhere, and in mad medicine that has always been a prescription for disaster. In fact, if the past is any guide to the future, today we can only be certain of one thing. The day will come when people will look back at our current medicines for schizophrenia and the stories we tell to patients about their abnormal brain chemistry, and they will shake their heads in utter disbelief. This is the epilogue from the book Mad in America by Robert Whittaker. Almost enough to make you a schizophrenic. Yeah, really interesting stuff. I mean, this is a history of the abuses of folks held in hospitals from the very founding days of the Republic, and it's I think well worth reading. I mean, I knew about some of this stuff. We are all I think aware of the kind of, we have a shiver when we think of 5150s and forced incarceration, forced drugging. But we like to think that, oh, well, these drugs are necessary for these guys, as women, men and women talk to themselves, makes them better, cuts down their symptoms. But the research in this book, actually it's not just in this book, he's drawn together numerous sources, seems to indicate that these drugs make things worse, generally speaking. Although, you know, obviously in certain cases that might not be the case.
That's kind of a tendency. I read a book on the history of medical operations that were useless, and you read the original claim, circumcision, which can cure epilepsy and fits, and chronic masturbation, which of course ends up with you a debilitated skeletal wreck, or lobotomy, the things that the person who came up with that operation claimed that it would cure, and of course in the end apparently it did nothing. But the one thing constant in all of these useless operations were the grandiose claims for the operation and the length of time it took, and in some cases the person who created it never admitted that the thing really didn't do any good at all.
Well, it becomes a sort of like a scientific mythology that happens. If Whittaker's analysis is correct, I'll read a little bit more from chapter one. And again, we're going to be covering this we'll be having the actual author on the show at 10 o'clock on Sunday. Chapter one is called Bedlam in Medicine. And it begins with a quote from Benjamin Rush. Those of you who know history know Benjamin Rush is a famous American physician of the Revolutionary era. And his quote is, "Terror acts powerfully upon the body through the medium of the mind and should be employed in the cure of madness." Terror acts powerfully upon the body through the medium of the mind and should be employed in the cure of madness. And here's the first few paragraphs of this chapter. A visitor to the mad wards of Pennsylvania Hospital at the turn of the 19th century would have found the halls astir with an air of reform. A year earlier, in 1796 to be exact, the lunatics had been moved from unheated, dingy cells in the basement where they had often slept on straw and been confined in chains, to a new wing where their rooms were above ground. Here the winter chill was broken by a coal-fired stove, and occasionally the mad patients could even take a warm bath. Most important of all, they now began to receive regular medical treatments, a regimen of care, physician Benjamin Rush proudly told the Pennsylvania overseers that had, quote, lately been discovered to be effectual in treating their disorder. The introduction of medical treatments had been a long time coming. In 1751, when Quakers and other community leaders in Philadelphia had petitioned the Pennsylvania Colonial Assembly for funds to build the hospital, the first in the colonies, they had told of medical care that could help to restore sanity to the mad mind. "It has been found," wrote Benjamin Franklin, who authored the plea, "by the experience of many years, that above two-thirds of the mad people received in the Bethlehem Hospital in England, and therein treated properly, have been perfectly cured." English mad doctors had indeed been making such claims, and had even published books describing their effective treatments. However, while Franklin and his fellow Quakers may have hoped to bring such medicine to the colonies, they also had a second reason for building the hospital. There were, they wrote, too many lunatics going at large who are a terror to their neighbors, who are daily apprehensive of the violences they may commit. Society needed to be protected from the insane, and it was this second function, hospital as jail, that had taken precedence when the hospital opened in 1756. In those early years, the lunatics were kept in gloomy, foul-smelling cells and were ruled over by keepers who used their whips freely. Unruly patients, when not being beaten, were regularly chained to rings of iron, let into the floor or wall of the cell, restrained in handcuffs or ankle irons, and bundled into mad shirts that left the patient an impotent bundle of rot. A visiting reverend, Manessa Cutler, described the sorry scene. We next took a view of the maniacs. Their cells are in the lower story, which is partly underground. These cells are about 10 feet square, made as strong as a prison. Here were both men and women between 20 and 30 in number. Some of them have beds, some of them clean straw. Some of them were extremely fierce and raving, nearly or quite naked, some singing and dancing, some in despair. Some were dumb and would not open their mouths. The lunatics also had to suffer the indignity of serving as a public spectacle. After the hospital opened, visiting the mad had quickly become a popular Sunday outing, similar to visiting a zoo. Philadelphians were eager to get a glimpse of these wretched creatures, with good sport on occasion to be had by taunting them, particularly those restrained in irons and easily roused into a rage. So frequent were the public's visits and so disturbing to the insane that the hospital managers erected a fence in 1760 to prevent the disturbance which is given to the lunatics confined in the cells by the great numbers of people who frequently resort and converse with them. But even an iron fence couldn't keep the public at bay, and so, in 1762, the hospital, trying to make the best of an unfortunate situation, began charging a visitor's fee of 4 pence. All of this began to change once Benjamin Rush arrived at the hospital in 1783. The lunatics could not have hoped for a more kind-hearted man to be their advocate. Born of Quaker parents, Rush was constantly championing liberal humanitarian reforms. As a young man, he had been a member of the Continental Congress and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He'd advocated for the abolition of slavery and prison reform, and he'd brought the same compassion to his treatment of the mad. At his request, the hospital's governing board built a new wing for the insane patients, which was completed in 1796. And soon, many patients were enjoying the comforts of rooms furnished with hair mattresses and feather beds. Those who were well-behaved were allowed to stroll about the hospital grounds and engage in activities like sewing, gardening, and cutting straw. Rush also believed that games, music, and friendship could prove helpful, and the hospital even agreed to his request that a well-qualified person be employed as a friend and companion to the lunatics. The insane, he explained to hospital attendants, needed to be treated with kindness and respect. Everything necessary for their comfort should be provided for them, and every promise made to them should be faithfully and punctually performed. But such humanitarian care could only go so far. Rush was also a man of science. He'd studied at the University of Edinburgh, the most prestigious medical school in the world at that time. There he'd been mentored by the great William Cullen, whose First Lines on the Practice of Physic was perhaps the leading medical text of the day. The European mad doctors had developed a diverse array of therapeutics for curing madness, and Rush, eager to make Pennsylvania Hospital a place of modern medicine, employed their methods with great vigor. And this treatment was of an altogether different sort. One of the first English physicians to write extensively on madness, its nature, and the proper treatments for it was Thomas Willis. He was highly admired for his investigations into the nervous system, and his 1684 text on insanity set the tone for the many medical guides which will be written over the next 100 years by English mad doctors. The book's title neatly summed up his view of the mad: The Practice of Physic, Two Discourses Concerning the Soul of Brutes. His belief that the insane were animal-like in kind reflected prevailing conceptions about the nature of man. The great English scientists and philosophers of the 17th century, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, John Locke, and others, had all argued that reason was the faculty that elevated humankind above the animals. This was the form of intelligence that enabled man to scientifically know his world and to create a civilized society. Thus, the insane, by virtue of having lost their reason, were seen as having descended to a brutish state. They were, Willis explained, fierce creatures who enjoyed superhuman strength. They can break cords and chains, break down doors or walls. They are almost never tired. They bear cold, heat, watching, fasting, strokes, and wounds without any sensible hurt. The mad, he added, if they were to be cured, needed to hold their physicians in awe and think of them as their tormentors. Discipline, threats, fetters, and blows are needed as much as medical treatment. Truly, nothing is more necessary and more effective for the recovery of these people than forcing them to respect and fear intimidation. By this method, the mind, held back by restraint, is induced to give up its arrogance and wild ideas, and it soon becomes meek and orderly. This is why maniacs often recover much sooner if they are treated with tortures and torments in a hovel instead of with medicaments. A medical paradigm for treating the mad had been born, and 18th century English medical texts repeated regularly this basic wisdom. In 1751, Richard Meade explained that the madman was a brute who could be expected to attack his fellow creatures with fury like a wild beast, and thus needed to be tied down and even beat to prevent his doing mischief to himself or others. Thomas Bakewell told of how a maniac bellowed like a wild beast and shook his chain almost constantly for several days and nights. I therefore got up, took a hand whip, and gave him a few smart stripes upon the shoulders. He disturbed me no more. Physician Charles Bell, in his book, Essays on the Anatomy of Expression in Painting, advised artists wishing to depict madmen to learn the character of the human countenance when devoid of expression and reduced to the state of lower animals. Like all wild animals, lunatics needed to be dominated and broken. The primary treatments advocated by English physicians were those that physically weakened the mad, bleeding to the point of fainting, and the regular use of powerful purges, emetics, and nausea-inducing agents. All of this could even reduce the strongest maniac to a pitiful, whimpering state. William Cullen, reviewing bleeding practices, noted that some advised cutting into the jugular vein. Purges and emetics would make the mad patient violently sick, were to be repeatedly administered over an extended period. John Monroe, superintendent of Bethlehem Asylum, gave one of his patients 61 vomit-inducing emetics in 6 months, including strong doses on 18 successive nights. Mercury and other chemical agents, meanwhile, were used to induce nausea so fierce that the patients could not hope to have the mental strength to rave and rant. While nausea lasts, George Mann Burroughs advised, hallucinations of long adherence will be suspended and sometimes be perfectly removed or perhaps exchanged for others, and the most furious will become tranquil and obedient. It was, he added, far safer to reduce the patient by nauseating him than by depleting him, that is, by bleeding him. A near-starvation diet was another recommendation for robbing the madman of his strength. The various depleting remedies, bleedings, purgings, emetics, and nausea-inducing agents were also said to be therapeutic because they inflicted considerable pain, and thus the madman's mind became focused on this sensation rather than on his usual raving thoughts. Blistering was another treatment used for stirring great bodily pain. Mustard powders could be rubbed on a shaved scalp, and once the blisters formed, a caustic rubbed into the blisters to further irritate and infect the scalp. The suffering that attends the formation of these pustules is often indescribable, wrote one physician. The madman's pain could be expected to increase as he rubbed his hands in the caustic and touched his genitals, a pain that would enable the patient, quote, to regain consciousness of his true self, to wake from his supersensual slumber, and to stay awake. All of these physically depleting, painful therapies also had a psychological value. They were feared by the lunatics, and thus the mere threat of their employment could get the lunatics to behave in a better manner. Together with liberal use of restraints and an occasional beating, the mad would learn to cower before their doctors and attendants. In most cases, it has appeared to be necessary to employ a very constant impression of fear and therefore to inspire them with the awe and dread of some particular persons, especially of those who are to be constantly near them, Cullen wrote. This awe and dread is therefore, by one means or other, to be acquired. In the first place, by their being the authors of all the restraints, they may be occasionally proper, but sometimes may be necessary to acquire it even by stripes and blows. The former, although having the appearance of more severity, are much safer than strokes or blows about the head. Such were the writings of the English mad doctors in the 1700s. The mad were to be tamed, But were such treatments really curative? In the beginning, the mad doctors were hesitant to boldly make that claim. But gradually, they began to change their tune, and they did so for a simple reason. It gave them a leg up in the profitable madhouse business. This is, again, I've been reading to you from Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill by Robert Whittaker. And it doesn't look like things have changed much to me, folks. They aren't beating anymore. They're instead using these destructive drugs. But we're going to be talking more about that on Sunday. If you want to join us, you can. I'm going to be putting on the net a selection from this book, hopefully. You can go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org, actually, is the website. Sorry about that. And you'll hopefully soon, maybe tomorrow morning, I'll be able to do it by then, read a selection from the book. And you can also, you can actually find that on Amazon.com, where you can actually order the book if you want. You can better still get it from a local bookseller, so you support your local bookseller and not the
chains.
How
much is it?
And the book is, the paperback edition is $17.50. And the hardback edition, I think, is $26. And it's also in the library. It's a very good book. At least I found it fascinating. Again, I haven't tracked down all the references. I'm trying to also present some other points of view to contrast with this. There are some people who really are advocates of the use of psychotropic and what's called, atypical drugs, they're called now, which are the newest generation of profit-producing pharmaceuticals for the pharmaceutical companies. Amazing amounts of profits have been produced by these things.
Yeah, I was reading this thing here on clitorectomy, the book I read on ridiculous medical operations. They had the case, the woman stayed in her room and she read books. And she wasn't too interested in fashion getting married. A little snip of the clitoris and that, well, didn't exactly perk her up, but it made her more docile, according to her parents.
Well, it's all for her own good. Let's keep that in mind.
Yes.
It's one of those therapies, sort of like, emetics, blistering, beating, shock treatments, insulin
therapy. Actually, those were used. I was reading a book on King Charles II of England, and when he was dying of what seemed to have been kidney failure, he was treated with purgatives, emetics, blistering on the head, the whole bit. Actually, he was being tortured to death and kind of suggested to his doctors maybe he should be let alone, but of course they had to keep the king alive
and
give him every available treatment, so he got tortured
to
death.
That's actually discussed at length in Whittaker's book, and he also points out that when they claimed that they were successful in getting that treatment, and then that of course increased the prestige of the doctors.
You were usually better off in those days if you were poor and couldn't afford a doctor. Until very recently, you were better off with the midwife than the doctor delivering your kid who had diseases, or the doctor who operated on you and he had the apron from every operation to show he really knew his stuff. Even around the time of the Civil War, when things like Lister sterilization came out, I've read things. Oh, the doctor said this was crazy. And when Garfield was shot and the man was hanged for it, the assassin said, "I didn't kill him, it was the doctors did." Well, he took, something like a month to die. The doctors took him off somewhere, opened the window, closed the window. About 15 of them stuck fingers in the bullet wound, put him in the bed, suggested he should eat lots of meat. None of them tried to remove the bullet, and basically the doctors killed the president with their treatment.
If anybody has any thoughts, please give a call to us at 427-3772. What I'm going to do now is cover a couple of other topics. We're going to return to this, Barbara, on Sunday.
I really want to hear this.
Yeah, please call in and listen in if you'd like. Both, and also you can send in questions by email. There's a trial coming up tomorrow to give an update to folks. John Maurer is a homeless person who, what perhaps I should do is read this press release, which I have around here somewhere, if I can find it. Here we go. I even have the brief that his attorney is going to be I don't think I actually have the press release, but I think I can extemporize a bit. John Maurer is a homeless guy who used to sell, and still does occasionally, sell Street Spirit newspaper. And when, as I mentioned, the June issue of Street Spirit has an interview with the author of this book, Robert Whitaker, very interesting. And it's in the public library. If you want to go to the main branch, you can see Street Spirit, which covers lots of subjects, particularly of interest to people who are poor and on the streets. And a lot of us who are concerned about folks who are out there and afraid of getting there ourselves. John is you can actually see him. I think he works now at the hot dog stand downtown near the bookshop Santa Cruz. And he was doing panhandling for a number of months, sitting on the sidewalk. And he was, police began to harass him by his account, and indeed to some extent by my observation. And he was ticketed under the downtown ordinances, the ordinances in Santa Cruz passed by the Riley Porter Council and made worse by the Kennedy-Rotkin Council. I guess it's the Kennedy-Riley Council right now. Riley's a mayor, Kennedy's a vice mayor, which make essentially 95% of the sidewalk illegal to sit on in a business district, and 75% of it illegal to set up a political table on or play a musical instrument on with a display device that's on the sidewalk. All essentially to pander to some merchant paranoia about poor and homeless people being around in downtown and distracting from or having deleterious effect upon business. Anyway, Maurer was getting harassed by the police, and he became so upset about it that what he eventually did was he wrote a little sign and it stuck it in his hat, a kind of like 3x5 card sign that said, "Fuck the pigs." And then at the end of that, in parentheses, it said police. So if people didn't understand, he wasn't talking about the local swine, but about the armed officers who were telling him that he had to move every 60 minutes under the move-along law, which is a new law passed by city council, which makes it illegal to gather voter petition signatures in one place for more than 60 minutes. And it's also being used primarily against poor people. Just say, you can't sit here for 60 minutes. We're going to make it uncomfortable for you to use the public spaces. Get going. Spend money or get your ass out of town is the message. So Maurer was arrested. Well, he was non-custodially arrested, which means he was held, given a citation, and then released. He wasn't taken to jail. He wasn't put in handcuffs, but he was essentially detained. If he tried to leave, he would have been taken away. So he was arrested. That's what the word arrest technically means. But he wasn't actually taken into custody, but he was in essence told he had to come to court. He had to pay what probably amounted to a $162 fine. And then he was arrested. He was given a second citation for it, which means he might face up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. Because if you do things like sleep after 11 o'clock at night anywhere in the city, even in your own vehicle that is legally parked, that is a crime. In the first case, it's an infraction. In the second case, it can be a misdemeanor, which is up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. It's even a year in jail. I'm not sure if it's 6 months or a year at this point. So constitutional attorney Paul Sanford became interested in this case, and he went to court to defend John Maurer. And he, in fact, is defending him in a trial tomorrow at 10 a.m., in Department 1, for those of you who want to come down to this trial. 10 a.m., Department 1, 701 Ocean Street. That's the flat iron building next to the five-story county building right across the river at Ocean and Water. Department 1, 10 o'clock, John Maurer. And the arguments that Paul Sanford makes are very interesting. They fundamentally say, if you want to criticize a police officer with a sign, that's got to be legal in a democracy with the First Amendment, or it doesn't mean anything. You haven't got a democracy, and you haven't got the First Amendment. If you want to stand up and start screaming at people and get in their face, that could be an assault. But to have a little sign, that can't be illegal. And the Santa Cruz City Council has made it illegal. So that law, according to Attorney Paul Sanford, is an unconstitutional law. And that's the issue that's going to be discussed and possibly decided tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the court of Junk Justice Irwin Joseph. That's Commissioner Joseph. And I call him Junk Justice Joseph for a very good reason. He is an amiable enough fellow. He'll smile at you, and he'll read you your rights, unlike some judges, some judicial officers, like referee John Mulligan in the basement, who usually hears infractions. If you normally get a ticket, like an infraction ticket of any kind in Santa Cruz, your case will automatically go to the basement court of a referee, John Mulligan. Disqualify him. Don't think twice. Disqualify him with a peremptory challenge. If you don't do that, you'll end up in his court, and you'll end up essentially at his mercy doing what he is essentially a fine-generating machine. That's been my experience with referee Mulligan. He doesn't respect your rights. He may try you in absentia if you don't happen to be there in violation of court process. He isn't held in check by other judges. He's been on the bench for 15 years, 13 years. He is, thankfully, retiring in November. But anyway, if you disqualify Mulligan, you'll go to the court of either Joseph or Siegel. And John Maurer ended up in Joseph's court. And I call him as adjunct Justice Joseph because of the way he's treated poor and homeless people in a number of cases. Most recently, he went after chalkers. There were two individuals who chalked on the sidewalk downtown in erasable chalk bought at the Pacific stationery store. Is that Pacific Stationery? It's Palace Stationery. That's what it is. These stores get confusing to me. Right next to the Cinema 9. It says sidewalk chalk on the box. I've chalked on the sidewalk for years. It's washable. It washes away. It wears away. It's First Amendment activity. I mean, I suppose if you went around chalking on private property on people's doorways or something, that might be something else. But to chalk on the public sidewalk is traditionally recognized as a free speech forum. Well, the city decided under pressure from the merchants that they wanted to stop demonstrations downtown, rein in the kind of political activism that was going on, and they arrested Becky Johnson, a local activist who also happens to produce this show. This is a moment of candor here. I mean, I do have, she's a close friend of mine, for writing on the sidewalk, "Sleep is not a crime," and also for drawing a peace symbol. She was convicted of chalking on the sidewalk. Under what law? There's no law that makes it illegal to chalk on the sidewalk. There's a law that makes it illegal to deface or damage the sidewalk. How can it be considered defacing or damaging? Well, you've got to talk to Junk Justice Joseph, because he apparently gets his cue from the same city attorney that sold out the De Anza mobile home and Clearview Court people, John Barisoni. There's a whole different agenda here in Santa Cruz than in many other places. Or maybe it's the same agenda, because I see a kind of an anti-homeless, anti-poor agenda. And in some extent, people in mobile homes, though they're not as poor as people on the streets who are homeless, they are not as rich as the folks that the Manufactured Houses Corporation would like to see on that property. Wouldn't you think, Barbara?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
One of my neighbors is totally disabled in his $20,000 trailer. I guess he gets SSI probably $700 a month.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't think I exaggerate when I call him Junk Justice Joseph. He also doesn't like it when you tape record his court proceedings. It requires an endless tussle to get basic rights. You do have the right to record your own judicial hearing, for instance, under 980D of the California Rules of Court. It can only be denied for cause, but Junk Justice Joseph apparently wants you to run by a transcript or not to do it, and he has never allowed a recording for broadcast purposes. So that while we've been able to get some recordings of these trials for personal use, if I play that tape on the air, I'll be arrested for contempt of court by Junk Justice Joseph. So, I can't do that, but you can go down tomorrow and see the trial of John Maurer at 10 a.m. in Department 1 if you're interested. A couple of quick updates. I went today to court to support local man Bajana Romero, who's one of the, I call the Borders kids. You may notice when you walk by Borders, often there are folks between those two benches on the Pacific Avenue side of Borders, hanging out, playing music, gabbing, whatever they're doing, talking, sitting in a circle, making jewelry, the usual sort of stuff. And the merchants and the police and the hosts and the redevelopment agency have taken to this relentless campaign to get rid of these kids. They have done things like they fenced off the New Leaf Market area, the area between the two kiosks at New Leaf Market. You may remember used to be an area where you could sit on the planter. They put in fences so they turn it into a private area for the merchants. Yeah, it was to help New Leaf Market and what was then Sushi Now and Alibaba's Cafe, what is now, I guess, Alfredo's, Alfresco's, and Cafe Campesino. But it was primarily done because the redevelopment agency decided they wanted to get rid of that scene there, that youth scene, just like they got rid of Hippie Corner, which used to be at Cathcart and Pacific, by planting a lot of flowers along a half-inch strip, the idea being that you could no longer lean against the fence. We have an incoming call here. Hi, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, turn down your radio.
Okay.
Way down.
Hello.
Way, way down. Nope. Still up there. Maybe that's us. Nope, that's you. How you doing?
Yeah, okay. My name is Rick. Hello, is this Robert?
It is.
Yeah, Robert, you took a little tape of me down in front of the Vets building. I thought you said it was going to be on Thursday.
Oh, you know, is this Maurice?
Yeah.
Oh, Maurice, yeah. I can give you a brief plug today, Maurice. We've gotten kind of bumped. I apologize. That's going to be going on Sunday instead, probably around 12:30 on Sunday morning. I apologize for you know, you've been listening to all this. We had this more immediate crisis. But why don't you speak for a few moments briefly about what's happening at the Vets Hall and what needs to be done? I know you're facing pressure to get rid of the ham radio scene that's going on in the Vets Hall you've had there for some years, right?
Right, yeah. Well, we're still taking signatures on our petition in front of the Vets building. We'll be doing that until the 30th. And then we'll be presenting them to the Board of Supervisors, hoping that they let us keep that little nook up there. We handle emergency communications during the time of disaster, and we're also in touch with the VA hospitals, and we're all licensed people. We're hams for a long time, and they want to move us out of there and rent a little space out to a physical therapist, which is the same thing as a massage parlor. And they're not using the rest of that building efficiently. There's plenty of room, plenty of spaces that are empty. It's just a matter of a power trip. So that's what it's all about, Robert. Over.
Hey, you did a very eloquent interview on that, and people who want more description of this can, of course, go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org, where there is a story. Maurice, I guess somebody else interviewed you on the air. Not on the air. They interviewed you in person, and they wrote about it. And it's on the Indie Media website, www.santacruz.indymedia.org. And I will be talking about this next time on Sunday. I'm sorry. This often happens. I will tell folks that something's going to be on, and then I'll find I'm running out of time and I can't do it. And I apologize to you now. I'm going to try to have it on Sunday. Maybe what I should do is call you before Sunday to confirm that that's going to happen. It's definitely going to be coming on one of these shows. I'm just not sure when. And since you do have a deadline, I guess you're going to the supervisors on what date?
Well, the next supervisor meeting is on October 7th, and we supposed to be talking to Andy, that's Marty's aide, tomorrow morning.
Andy Schifrin, yeah.
And so, and maybe we might get it on their agenda, but we have to talk with our district supervisor first.
Well, you know, the issue I think has been that the vets have been trying to protect, and you pointed this out very eloquently in your interview, that a lot of vets are homeless, a lot of vets are poor, and there's been this pressure on the Vets Hall to give up the space to more money-making groups. I guess a masseur wants to put a masseur in the place where you have your radio right now, where the vets have their radio on the second floor. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
We have the vets helping vets down in the basement. We have a food program going on, 3 days a week,
mm-hmm.
and we have a continental breakfast down there. Another 2 days a week. So,
what time is that for those vets who are listening and want to make use of that program?
Well, if you have a VA card or you're a member of any of the veterans organizations, you're certainly welcome to come down here and get your little nourishment, you know. I'm a World War II combat veteran. I don't need that service, but I provide help to them. I pick up what's left at the Safeway and take it down there once a week, and we all support each other instead of rivaling each other, instead of squabbling with them. Of course, there's a lot of that goes on, too. So that's the thing, Robert. Over.
Yeah, and I know you also are supportive of the folks at De Anza Mobile Home and at Clearview Court. You talked about that in the interview, too, and that'll be coming up again. And I'm really hoping that those folks can all get together. I'd hope to hear from them, but I've only got about 5 minutes left in the show, and I'm going to be quickly dispossessed from the studio, so I got to get moving pretty soon. But what's a phone number people can call in and get information on this from, Maurice, if they want?
Well, they can call me if you want to. My home phone number is 426-5409, and I'll provide what information I have. There's other people involved. Or come the best is to come down in front of the Vets building tomorrow, and we'll have a table down there starting about 10 to about 2, and we'll have information right there at the table in front of 846 Front Street.
And give me your number again, Maurice.
426-5409.
And Barbara, before you leave, I know you're going to be leaving shortly.
Yes, I was wondering, isn't the Veterans Hall for vets?
Well, it was until they wanted to decide to make money, use it to make money because of the budget squeeze, you know.
Yeah.
They don't get enough money from the state capital, and the state capital don't get enough money from the national capital, and so all the surplus has been used, it's been turned into a deficit, and we're all hunting for money. Over.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's, I mean, and it's a real problem, but, you know, it's I guess it means that the folks at the bottom, this is the time we've got to get together and stand together here, or they pick us off one by one. It's the usual, you know, unless we hang together, we all hang separately. Old Ben Franklin's words of wisdom.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Robert, for putting what you can. And, of course, you're going to mention my book, you know.
I am. But and why don't you mention it before you go?
Well, I do have a book out. It's on Amazon.com. It's called As It Was by Maurice Ricketts. And you can click Amazon.com under that title, under my name, and get 3 reviews there, what it's about. It's a memoir. Was raised in Wyoming during the Depression, and I was in the National Guard Horse Cavalry at 16 years old, and I was in the Navy when I was 18 for 6 years, and combat in the North Atlantic and the South Pacific. So I'm 81, but next month.
Hey, we'll have to have a birthday party.
Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Hey, thanks, Maurice.
You're doing a terrific job.
Hey, I wish I were doing better. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, you've been listening to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. In this particular edition, we've been concerned and will continue to be concerned with fighting back against city council, well, the destruction of rent control, the betrayal of promises to hundreds of seniors and to the community generally, and the destruction of rent control's impact on the community. Hi, you're on Free Radio, very briefly.
Robert?
Yes.
I just wanted to let you know that one of those rooms in the vet hall was rented out to kids like theater camp this summer.
Uh-huh.
It was about $750 a pop, and about 30 kids attended. So they're trying to turn that into a little she-she, that building. I don't understand why the vets building is no longer for the vets.
You know, it's interesting. I think there's a division in the building. They made an agreement. There was a judicial settlement. Maurice talked about this in his interview, and I'm hoping again to have this played.
Well, you can go into it next week, but I'm just saying they made a, you know, whoever rented it made a fortune. It'd be interesting to know how much rent they paid.
Right, and I also want to hope that we can also go into the final disposition of Orly and Stacy when we have time, the folks whose kids were taken.
Right.
And maybe at some point we can go into that. I know you've got an update on that.
Well, that's all. I just wanted to make that point that they're renting it to very high-income private enterprise.
Here. Yeah. And that's about it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I appreciate, Barbara, your coming. And do you want to give a number people can call if they want more information, or do you want them to call me and then I can pass?
We don't actually have a number. We don't. Clearview Court has no visitor parking, no clubhouse. We just carry our chairs out into the street and meet, and I'm not sure what, of the court, of the trailer court. I'm not really sure what number I could give.
Well, you could give, I'll tell you what, if anybody wants...
I'll ask some people see if there's a number they want to give.
Right, why don't you do that, and I will give out my number, and if anybody wants to contact you, they can call and leave a message with me, and I will get in touch with you. you can give me your phone number, and I will call you up and let you know about that, so you don't have to give it out publicly on the air.
Actually, at Clearview Court, we really don't know anything. We haven't heard from the city. We don't know what deal is going to be offered, what's going to be done, and we won't until apparently the end of October. So we're just as confused as anybody.
Okay. Well, then that's down the road. I'm going to be getting down the road, too. I want to thank you for staying on this edition of Bathroom Serious Broadsides this long, and I hope you can take a longer dose on Sunday. Again, Robert Whitaker, Mad in America, special interview from 10 to 11:30. I recommend you check it out. It's going to be a very interesting show, I predict. Go to the Santa Cruz Indie Media for more information on it. And tomorrow, Peace Friday, check out Peace Friday. That's going to be at the usual place at Water and Pacific. I'm sorry, at Water and Ocean. And I'm going to just roll out as soon as I find out where the appropriate cut is on this CD. Here we go. Next up is Uncle Dennis. And From the Cream to the Dregs. Meantime, give a call to 423-HUFF if you've got any questions, and tune in again on Sunday at 9:30.
We treat the homeless like discarded trash, never knowing what to do when we pass. Do I stare? Do I look away? I don't know, I ain't got very much to say to you. I'll give a nickel, I'll give a dime. I'll say I'm sorry, I haven't got the time for you. 'Cause the bricks in the window are all turning gray. The wind is blowing, I can't look away. For the stench of the homeless and the rotting streets are cast upon me like the shoes on my feet. Shoes on my feet. And his mutual funds, and he'll tell you that his life is so much fun. He's got an ulcer and addicted wife, and little Johnny's doing 25 years of life. Years of life. He's got a Lexus and a lot of cash. But the Christians say that stuff just won't last. So why do so many covet that stuff? I guess that Jesus just can't turn above. Turn above. 'Cause the bricks in the window are all turning gray. The wind is blowing, I can't look away. All the stench of the homeless and the rotting streets are cast upon me like the shoes on my feet.